Son Kevin Davis was released from Elmira Correctional Facility after serving 7 years on a weapons charge. He made a surprising choice. The hardened native of Brownsville, Brooklyn, a black man, left his New York City home and returned to Elmira, ostensibly to live a quieter, simpler life. There he met a white woman and started a family, but his efforts to reintegrate into society turned out to be a lot more difficult than he imagined, and they're the subject of a new book by Greg Donaldson called Zebra Town. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Donaldson to our show today. Hello.
Nice of you to invite me.
How did you meet Kevin Davis?
I wrote a book called The Ville, 1993, about the neighborhood of Brownsville. And for the book, the publishers provided me with a photo, which I didn't like. It was a picture of a woman holding a child in front of some dilapidated buildings, and I thought that that looked like defeat to me. So they said, well, you should go out and take your own picture. So I did. I brought a photographer out, and I went out, and I saw a group of young men standing beneath a flagpole in the Tilden Projects, and I asked them if I could take their picture, and they said no. That, as a matter of fact, we should back up quickly and remove ourselves from the area. And as we backed up, a car backfired in the street, and they all turned to it. And at that moment, the photographer went down to one knee and snapped a picture that's on the cover of The Ville. And when the book came out, detectives in the 73rd Precinct and the PSA 2, which is the housing police, took a look at it, and they said, we want him, and we want him for a homicide at 10 Amboy Street.
And so Kevin, and one of them was Kevin Davis.
Yes, that was Kevin.
So he went to prison for that homicide?
He went to prison for a charge related to that homicide, weapons possession.
But he did have a nickname in prison that was related to the homicide.
Yeah, they call him in prison Killer Kev, KK. To this day, they call him KK. It's part his boxing name, his nickname in the boxing ring, and it's also his street name.
So he came across as a tough guy. Is that the way he got through prison?
Well, he is a tough guy.
Mm-hmm. He's a tough guy. Well, but there are a lot of tough guys in prison.
Well, yeah, Kevin combines some very interesting qualities. He's not only fearless, he's also a boxer, and he's also a very, very good reader of human nature. You walk onto a prison yard, he can read people's hostility at a glance, and he's also very theatrical in a sense that he can head things off by his maneuvers. So he's a very interesting character.
Also adopted a lot of the artifacts of the hip-hop culture. Is that important?
Well, it's not so much that Kevin adopted the artifacts of the hip-hop culture, it's that the hip-hop culture adapts artifacts from Kevin.
Okay. Well, and so he was wearing baggy clothing before other people were?
A lot of the language that hip-hop music, gangster rap music, and young people use comes from the inner city. It comes from the inner city through the prison system. It's and the styles of clothing, yes, started in those kinds of areas. And yes, they were wearing those kinds of clothing before they became national, international, and using the slang that later on became national and international.
So you took this picture of Kevin against his will. That's not exactly a good introduction to somebody. How did you wind up communicating with him?
When he got out of prison, he got my email address somehow. And
he remembered that he'd been on the cover of your book?
Oh, he certainly did. He carried the book with him for 8 years in prison. He used it to his advantage, the charge against him and the fact that the book wasn't written about him. He was just a picture on the cover of the book. But it all added to his notoriety.
So what kind of a relationship did you develop?
I was concerned about meeting Kevin, especially since the photograph had been unauthorized, and I felt kind of bad about that.
But and he could have sued you.
I'm not so sure. The legal issues there are cloudy, but he certainly – it's not good to have a man named Killer Kev angry at you. So I agreed to meet him, and we met. And he said – he had said it before, and he said it again – after some initially tense moments, that I'm a reasonable man. And I was very interested, and he seemed to be, and I was very interested in him as an individual and also as a type, because I had written a book about Brownsville in which it was about a young man, a dreamy young man who wanted to be an actor and a young cop and an embattled principal and a teacher. But always in the neighborhood were these really tough guys, these thugs. There was one named Born Son, another named Boo Bear. And I had no access to them, really. And when I started to talk to Kevin, I could realize that this is what he was. He was an alpha in this society and in this neighborhood. And everybody had to react to him. The other young man had to be tougher because he was around, the teachers, the police. And so I thought access to him could be a very interesting thing.
But you had been a teacher in some tough Brooklyn schools. You also taught in the prisons. So you must have run into a lot of alphas.
Yes, I have.
Kevin more alpha than most of them?
Yes.
Did you feel that he was always telling you the truth when he was talking about his life and his story?
That's a very crucial aspect of the project and the book because as I listened to him, I noticed that his stories were consistent. I noticed that his stories were not self-aggrandizing. In some sense, they were, in some they weren't. But the real breakthrough came when I got a hold of his prison records. There were 450 pages of incident reports, and I could match up the stories that he would tell me about this small riot that he started at Attica, the fight he had in the yard at Orleans prison. And I can match them up with the incident reports. And he was actually understating his role many times.
Was it a surprise that he was let out, considering the fact that he was involved in all of those actions?
Yes, it was a surprise. Kevin's very smart, and he knows how to work the system. And apparently he was not involved in anything that would have increased his years significantly, although he spent a lot of time in solitary confinement.
It was also surprising, I would think, that he decided to move back to Elmira, where he had been in prison, rather than come to New York. Even if he didn't go back to Brownsville, he could have gone to a different kind of neighborhood and try to change his life.
Yeah, that was the idealistic part of it. He wanted to move to the very street he could see outside his prison cell window. He wanted to move to the peaceful, scenic area that he could feel and see from the windows of the prison. And it is beautiful in Elmira, but he didn't realize that there were no jobs if the Rust Belt.
Well, many years ago, I was friends with somebody who had been to prison for a much less dangerous bit of criminal activity. And he found it very hard to find a job. He'd been trained as a draftsman, but not well by the New York prison system. And eventually he wound up back in prison.
Yeah, Kevin has a very hard time finding a job in the book, although he doesn't mind working. He likes the discipline. He likes actually, he likes the rigor of it.
Did he learn a trade in prison?
No. No, he didn't.
He got a job road managing a rapper. Well, that seems like an appropriate job for somebody like him.
That was, a very good position, but his temper destroyed that job when he was disrespected by the label rep. He reacted and knocked him out and lost his job.
And his temper seems to be a problem all along in this story.
Yeah, and it's not just an explosive temper, although that is a problem. He has taken anger management classes and should take more, but it's kind of his ethic. It's his rules of conduct that have to undergo some change.
My guest is Greg Donaldson, whose book Zebra Town, The True Story of a Black Ex-Con and a White Single Mother in Small Town America, is published by Scribner. Is Kevin typical of ex-cons who want to go straight but have acquired few of the skills necessary to live normal lives?
In some sense, he's typical. The obstacles that he faces, the employment obstacles. There's a company in Elmira called Kennedy Valve. It's run by McWayne Industries. It's one of legendarily dangerous. There was a Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles in the New York Times about it. And Kevin couldn't even get a job in there. One of the economists at Elmira College said that Kevin couldn't get into the third circle of hell to work. And so that is an ongoing issue, as are other collateral punishments that prisoners face. This book is not about those things, but it kind of shows those things. They can't get student loans. They can't live in public housing. There's all kinds of things that they can't do.
Well, the Fortune Society was created to help people get past these obstacles. Is there no Fortune Society in Elmira, or is a group like that just too limited because there are just so many people out there who need help?
I think that's the answer. I think that I'm not aware of a group like that in Elmira, but there are 630,000 inmates released every year into society.
And many of them stay in town?
Not in Elmira, across the country. There's a trend of inmates staying out of the urban areas that they came from and staying up there.
Well, I can understand why they would want to avoid falling back into the same old patterns. There's a section of Elmira named Zebratown, which gives your book its title. How did that name come about?
There are a number. I was taken aback when I first went up there with Kevin that there were so many interracial couples there, predominantly black men and white women, and their children. And coming from New York, I thought we were the most diverse area anywhere, but certainly not when it comes to that kind of interracial relationships. And there's an area of town on the east side that the locals themselves called Zebratown because it's populated by black men and white women.
And in this case, he meets a woman named, you've given her the name Karen Tansky. Kevin Davis is the real name of your subject, but this is not her real name. What attracted them to each other?
Kevin saw in her, she's has some years of college, she went to Elmira Business Institute. He saw in her the American dream, an intelligent, attractive woman with prospects. She saw in him a attractive, intelligent, focused individual with some bit of romance to his past.
You mean the fact that he's a bad boy, which is attractive to
exactly.
some women.
And beyond that, he's a man who means what he says. He's not he's not a lightweight. And she found that attractive.
You have Kevin's letters and Karen's journal entries in this book. Did they give you access to them?
Yes. Kevin was anxious that his story be told. The access to Kevin was very good. He would tell and give you just about anything. Karen was a bit reluctant, but her letters, she's not that talkative as Kevin is, but her letters from prison, I think, were a highlight of the book.
And what do they reveal about their life together, their relationship?
Well, it's a love affair in the sense that Kevin really loves Karen and she loves him, and you can see it in the letters, and their struggles against their economic problems and struggles also against other ideas that they have that Kevin doesn't really understand what it takes to be the head of a family.
On the other hand, she's far from ideal. She was arrested for drug possession.
Right.
So this is not exactly the kind of behavior we want from a young mother.
Right. She wasn't an angel. She had been in some, she had little brushes with the law before she met Kevin, but the drug possession charge that she ended up going to prison was a direct result of Kevin's associations.
Uh-huh. How did she fare in prison? Kevin thrived in prison.
Kevin thrived in prison because Kevin runs his life as if he's the star of his own film, and he's very optimistic and very he thinks that everything revolves around him. He's very self-centered. Karen is more of just a regular person, saw herself in prison and she was pregnant while she was in prison. She gave birth in prison.
How did that work out?
Ironically, the birth of Kay Dawn it worked out better than it might have worked out if she had had the baby at home. She had more time to pay attention to the child. She had support services. She had the counseling of some very, very interesting women. She met Judy Clark while she was in prison, the 60s radical who's been doing so much time there and who leads the Mothers and Nurturing Mothers program. So she had some good counseling. She had plenty of time. And so in a way, it was tragic. In another way, it worked out well.
Are Karen and Kevin still together?
No.
He's back in prison, isn't he?
He was sentenced to a year for a domestic violence incident involving Karen, and he did, with good time and time served, he got out, I think, in April, and he's been out since then.
But this is another example of him not being able to manage his anger, despite the anger management training.
Exactly.
And she's, is she afraid for her life?
You know, I find that one of the things I learned from this book is how brave some women can be, especially in these potentially lethal domestic violence situations, because Kevin can be scary. And she took it to the limit. She testified against him in court, and he went to prison, and I don't think she's afraid of him now. I think he's accepted the separation.
We want these stories to have a different kind of arc. Kevin works hard, and eventually he gets a job, and he's, because he's smart, he does well. But this sounds more like the kind of story that people who, say, throw him in prison and throw away the key would say is what they fear most.
Well, there are two issues there. One, the arc of redemption and inspiration is that's, in many cases, a created fiction that people find pleasing but doesn't really reflect reality of life. And so that's why I like this genre, because I'm watching and writing what happens, not what I hope would happen or what would lift people's spirits. The other part that you said about this being fodder for people who would say throw away the key, that is one of the dangers of this book that I worried about. I think, you know, first when you write something like this, you have the doctor's credo, first do no harm. And I don't want to supply any fodder for that argument. And this book is not an argument. But in some ways, if you read the book, you can read it another way. If Kevin had had employment opportunities, if Kevin had had support services, if Kevin had had better schools and better upbringing, if he hadn't been from such a troubled neighborhood, one of the best ways to prevent the arc that you see in this book is to stop it from starting.
Greg Donaldson is an associate professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. His latest book is called Zebra Town, The True Story of a Black Ex-Con and a White Single Mother in Small Town America, published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.